I note to you and remind you that next week will be at this time the Lucy Davidovich lecture, the annual lecture in memory of the late great historian who was a part of Congregation Or Zarua, and it is our lecture that celebrates our birthday. So we will celebrate the 23rd birthday next week on Wednesday night, and then following Shabbat we will have our birthday Kiddush next Wednesday night. We'll have our speaker, Dr. Sharon Lieberman Mintz, who is the curator of Judaica in the library of the Jewish Theological Seminary, who is an expert on manuscripts and the illumination of manuscripts. She was a key player, one of the people who worked on the great exhibit at Sotheby's about 3 years ago, the Rev. Al Madonna collection, and then the Brzezinski collection, which was just, I think, a year and a half ago or so, down at Yeshiva University Museum. She did that. And she is going to be lecturing on envisioning Esther, scrolls of Esther and their illuminations. So I think it will be a first, as I always hope these lectures will be, and I think it will be something that you will want to be at. So that's next Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. Not yet sure where it's going to be, to tell you the truth. It may be in this room. Normally we do these lectures in the sanctuary, but we have to work out a good way that you can project slides. And it's more effective if we do it here. We can set up screen and slides in this room, and probably we'll do it up here, or we may do it downstairs in the social hall. But that's next Wednesday evening. Now, we are discussing a subject that is, on the one hand, rather practical, on the other hand, absolutely impractical, and that is the abstract subject of Eim la Mikra, or Eim la Masoret. That is something that came up in a legal discussion. The discussion was based on our deriving the minimal number of judges that are necessary in a court of monetary claims. And we had always assumed, from reading the Mishnah and from all the discussion that has proceeded until what we came to last week, that number was three, that a court was three. And we saw last week that Rabbi Judah the Prince, took the point of view that the court was five. The first thing that we contemplated was, how could that possibly be, because the Mishnah itself says three? So he wrote the Mishnah, so he says, you know, how could it be? So the first, and what seemed like a very logical possibility, was that, well, when he says that it's three, he didn't mean the size of the court is three, but he meant that the decision would be made by three. And the only way you can make a decision by three, the minimum number of people you have to have in your court is five. So we went down that road for a while, until the Gemara eventually demolished that whole line of thinking. The Gemara will do that. The Gemara, it sucks you in. You read it and you say, oh yeah, it's right. I agree with you completely. I didn't think of this before. How can I not have thought? And it says, you keep going, go, go. And the Gemara says, dummy, I got you again. You thought that this was right? It's ridiculous, this argument. It's ridiculous. And it goes on to show how ridiculous the whole argument is, because if you were to apply that principle, then you'd have a court of 71 would have to be a court of 142. It's a ridiculous argument. Oh, so, all right, so we're back to where we started from. So then the Gemara says, well, we had thought that we had figured out Rebbe's reasoning, that it was a logical reason, and that he had simply meant one thing in the Mishnah, and we thought he meant another thing. That wasn't it at all. This is a matter of interpretation of texts. And there is a source that we base our number 3 on. It's the source in the book of Exodus, the 22nd chapter, beginning with verse 6. And that is when a man gives money or goods to another for safekeeping, they are stolen from the man's house. If the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, the owner of the house shall... Here it says deposed before God, but I want to read the Ibn Nikra, Bal Habayit Ela Elohim. The owner of the house, namely the person in whose trust this object was put, that person has to, Nikrav, go to the Elohim. And Elohim was understood by the Talmud to mean a judge. So that was verse 7. And then a little further on, let's see what it says here. I'll call Pesha, verse 8, in all charges of misappropriation pertaining to an ox, an ass, a sheep, a garment, or any other loss where one party alleges this is it. The case of both parties shall come before who? HaElohim. Elohim. He whom HaElohim declares to be guilty. All right, 3 times HaElohim. 3 times Elohim. So we assume one position is 3 times Elohim. But then there was a problem. Rebbe says it's 5. So where does he get 5 from? Well, the second mention of Elohim, it says this in this verse 8. It says first, let's see, I'll call the Varad, I'll show you. Yomar lo ki hu ze ad ha Elohim yavo, devar shnehem. Okay, to the Elohim shall come the word of the both of them, these two parties who are arguing with each other. Asher yarshi'un Elohim. The one who Elohim declares to be guilty, yishalem shnayim. They have to pay double. Yarshi'un is plural. Yarshi'un is plural. So since in the second half of the verse it says 2 in the plural, you know, plural is 2. And in one verse we have the same word, Elohim, used twice. The first one probably also means 2. 2 plus 2 is 4. You can't have a court of 4. Right? Because that would be a hung court. It could be 2 and 2. So you have to have a court of 5. Ah, that's Rebbe's point of view. Well, if that's Rebbe's point of view, how do the rabbis have the other point of view of 3? Where do they come off? Oh, well, it turned out when we left this last that in fact there was a disagreement of interpretive principles between Rebbe and the rabbis. Because that word Yarshi'un, which we said was plural, is written Yud Resh Shin Ayin Nun. Ayin Yarshi'un, it was Ayin Nun, okay. Let me see if I got that right. I'm sorry, Reshud Yun, Yud Ayin Nun, Yud Ayin Nun, Yarshi'un. And the problem with the way that's written is it's written as Yud Reshin Yud Ayin Nun. And it's pronounced un, un. Normally, when you see un, you expect a vav there. There's no vav. There's a kubutz, 3 dots underneath the ayin. Okay? This is a case where, in fact, you could read it one way or you could read it another way. Or it's written one way and it's read another way. Ah, we had a concept then. The concept was Eim LaMikra, Rebbe takes the point of view that primacy goes to the oral tradition of how it is that we read the text. And the rabbis say, no, it goes rather not to the oral tradition, but em la masoret. It goes according to the masorah, the tradition of how the text is to be printed. Okay? So the printing was in the singular. The oral tradition has it in the plural. Rebbe takes the oral tradition, and that is a fundamental difference between Rebbe and the rabbis. And that's why Rebbe says 5 and the rabbis say 3. Okay? So it really hinges on a philosophical issue. A philosophical issue about how to relate to the text. How do we understand a text that essentially has to be read with pointing when there is no pointing in the text? Right? There are simply traditions, all traditions of how we are supposed to read the text. And in interpreting the text, we don't know which takes primacy, which is prime, which has primacy. Okay?
Which one might have come first, the oral listening, or, you know, would they have heard it and then written it down, and written down something that was kind of a mistranscription of the hearing?
Moses wrote it down.
Well, you're both right. Because the if, let's, I'll just give you a hypothetical, and I'm going to come back to this further on this evening, because the truth is the question that you're asking is an extraordinarily important question. So, but I'll just give you a hypothetical to begin with so that we could at least have some way to go. I would assume that God dictates, right? If Moses is writing the divine word, then God dictates. Okay, so Moses hears it first. So in fact, the oral has primacy to the written. On the other hand, I probably can reasonably assume that Moses wrote what he was supposed to write. Okay?
God,
he was not a creative writer. All right? He's writing what God tells him to write, and that, therefore, the way in which he wrote it is the right way, because there's no other possibility, really. We have the story in the Talmud and Menachot. Great story in Menachot. You want to give me, somebody give me your head. Henry, go find me Menachot. 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 It's probably about two-thirds of the way off to the left there. See whether this one says Menachot. It would say Zevachim Menachot, probably. Okay. You're terrific. Thank you so much. This is a little bit of an aside, but it's not really, because you'll see that this is relevant. In the third chapter of the Tractate Menachot. Menachot is a tractate that is about grain offerings. And as is characteristic of the Talmud, every time it tells you about something, it really tells you about something else. Let me just see if I'm right. Is that grain offering? And the second of Komet Ramban. Or is it Herkot Chelet? Memory, come on.
Only
the Talmud is not supposed to remember these things. You have to have a picture. So I remember where it is on the page, but I'm not sure which chapter it is. Either it's the third chapter or the fourth. I think it's the first one. I think it's the third. It's just such a good story, it's worth waiting for if I find it. Oh, getting close. Get the feel, it's almost here. Almost there. Getting warm. It was in the third chapter. This is a wonderful Agadah. Listen to this. Amar Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, following. Bisha'a sha'ala Moshe l'maro. When Moses went up to get the Torah up on high. Okay. Mitzaola HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheyoshev v'kosher kitarim la'otiyot. He saw that the Holy One, blessed be He, was affixing crowns to the letters. Okay? Now you know, if you've taken a look at a Torah scroll, Henry's is nodding here, you're a Torah reader. The Torah readers know that there are a variety of letters. Bagat Kafat, they all have crowns on them, and they must be written with the crowns. Why does it have to be written with the crowns? Okay, that's what this story comes together. Moshe went up to see God. He saw God putting the crowns on the letters of the Torah. Okay? He was fixing the crowns to the letters. Amar lefanav, Moses says to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, min yakev al yadcha. Who would say that you did it wrong? In other words, what difference does it make if you put a crown on you don't? Why are you being so careful about it? If you did it, it would be right. Right, the very definition of right is the way you do it. So why are you so carefully putting crowns on these letters and not on other letters? Amar lo, he said to him, Adam echad yesh atid lehiyot besof kamadarat. There will be a man who will appear at the end of many generations. The Akiva ben Yosef shemo, and his name is Akiva, Rabbi Akiva. Shatid lidrosh al kol kotz for kotz, who in the future will interpret every jot and tittle, every little thing that's in the Torah. He'll have piles and piles of halachot. Amar b'fanav, Moses says to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, harehu li, show him to me. Amar lo, he said to him, Chazor le'achorcha. Turn around. Halach v'yashav b'sof shmona shurot. Moses then went and sat in the last row of the academy where Akiva was teaching. It's just a wonderful setup here. Moses sits in the back. And of course, in the rabbinic academies, the dummy sits in the back. You know, the one who knows, you sit in the order. The more you know, the closer up you are to the rabbi. Yeah, Moses sits in the dummy's position. V'lo haya yodea mahen omrin. And Moses had absolutely no idea what they were saying. It's unbelievable. Okay, Moses couldn't follow the discussion. He had no idea what they were talking about. Tashash kocho, he got worn out.
What's that?
Tashash kocho, he got worn out. Kevan shehigia l'davar echad. At one point, Rabbi Akiva, in his teaching, came to one matter. Amru lo talmidav, and the students said to him, Rabbi, Master, ninayim lecha, how do you know that? Amar lahem, he said to them, Halacha l'Moshe miSinai. It's the law that we got from Moses on Mount Sinai. Nityashvat dato. Moses felt better. It's a masterpiece. It's unbelievable the way this is written. Chazar uba lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moses then came back to God. Amar lefanav, he said to him, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, yesh lecha adam kazeh, there is a man like this, v'ata noten Torah al yadi, and you give the Torah through my auspices? Rabbi Akiva should be the one who's up here now getting the Torah, not me. Who am I? Okay? Amar lo, God says to him, shtok, kach Allah b'machshava lefanai. Be quiet. This is my decree. Amar b'fanav, Moses says to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, Haritani Torato, you have shown me his Torah. Hareni Scharo, show me his reward. Amar lo, he says to him, Chazor la'achorcha, turn around. Chazor la'achorav, Moses turned around. Ra'a sheshoklim b'saro b'makolim. And he saw that they were weighing the flesh of Rabbi Akiva in the marketplace, because the Romans had massacred him. They cut his flesh with razors. Amar lefanav, Moses said to God, Ribono shel olam, Lord of the world, Zo Torah v'zo schara. This is the Torah, and this is its reward. Amar lo, says the Holy One, blessed be He, shtok, kach Allah b'machashava lefanai. Be quiet. This is my decree.
Oh, just ask the question.
This is my decree. The end of the story. Unbelievable piece of writing here. One of the most profound theological stories, I think, in the whole Talmudic literature. Essentially, God is in charge, to say the least, both in the most creative and in the most tragic way. The transcendence and the power of God here is beyond any question. And the beginning of it, you see, begins with Moses questioning, you know, why God makes letters the way they are. But the notion is that the writing itself is part of the divine revelation. So both aspects of it, even though I think logically the oral comes before the written, still both are essentially a basic part of the notion that we're discussing.
When I learned the Torah reading, I came across words where they were pronounced differently than they were written, because it was apparently agreed upon that they were incorrect.
Right, that's different.
So where does that come from?
Well, no, the ones that are incorrect, that's once in a while you've got a problem in the text. There are a few places like that. Some places there are traditions of reading things completely differently than they are written for the purpose of modesty. There are certain words that are not read publicly. And so you can't read Tisha Galma, for example. Tisha Galma means to have intercourse. You can't read that. You have to say Tisha Chavna, that they lay down together. So there are certain things where that's
modesty.
The reason. It's reasons of modesty, public modesty. So, but there are a few cases where there are some textual problems as well. But this is not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about the essential philosophical issue, really, of the nature of revelation. Revelation as something which is either seen or heard. And we'll go further with this. I don't want to exhaust us too much with it right now, because we have much yet to do with this.
The thing about writing is, though,
just not apparent. I mean, although it's there, you need Rabbi Akiva to interpret what it says.
Correct. Correct. So there really is yet another layer here. If I could take off from what you're saying, Henry, I don't know, I'm not sure whether this is what you're intending, but I'll go in that direction anyway. You absolutely, any time you have anything written, the reality is that you need interpretation. There's no such thing as something written that doesn't have interpretation. We may, again, I think I mentioned in another context, we may have that idea because we have a very practical sense of the use of language. We have a denotative sense of language in English, but just talk to a Frenchman for a while, and French is a much different, or Arabic. I'm convinced that if we understood more about Arabic, we'd probably be able to have a lot better relations with the Arabs, because, just to go back to the French for a moment, because I think it's more within our grasp, some of you speak French, I'm sure, and you know that when you engage in French, it's just, there's a drama to everything. Everything is a matter of, it's a Marie Chevalier comedy, almost. But that's the nature of that language. There's every words are partially there for what they mean, but they mean something way beyond what they say. That's just the way the language is. English, we're used to English being a much more descriptive type of language because of the nature of our society. But even the English, as a matter of fact, the English, say a good production of the BBC, for example, and you'll begin to see just even a sense of the English language, the way you can learn so much about how these wonderful actors just show you that language is a lot more pliable than we usually think that it is. But I think it's a basic problem of written texts in general that they require interpretation.
When we say halacha l'moshe l'sinai, l'toshba, l'torah shebal peh, are we talking on one episode at one time, or is it an accumulation of episodes for a certain amount of time? And who was responsible for the recording so we can come to the answer?
I don't answer that yet. I'll talk a little bit about that later. The answer is it's not a simple question to answer. There are essentially two answers. One is that it's all at once, and the other is that it happened sequentially. So those are the two possibilities.
And when it was finished?
Well, that we that I can't even say that that's clear. No, because the Torah ends a lot before. The Torah ends with the death of Moses.
Correct.
So the but the problem is, I could say it ends with the death of Moses, but the problem that I have then is, how do we know anything about the death of Moses?
Right.
Okay.
Or we throw everything to that pocket, you know.
It could be. But that's where it's somewhere. Those are the parameters of it anyway. Okay? Yes.
I get this from the Oxford Encyclopedia of Judaism, where I was taught that Yehuda Nasi was the one who redacted the Mishnah.
Correct, that's right.
And I didn't realize that this guy doesn't think he redacted the Mishnah. There were competing Mishnahs.
Correct.
And they decided that his was the one they were going to use.
Mm-hmm.
But more fundamentally, there were other ones that they could have used.
Correct. The nature of redaction doesn't mean composition. Redaction means the decision made between competing texts. And that's very basic to the notion of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is not somebody's creation, but it is a compilation of oral law. And the assumption is that that it goes way back. Well, it was in different forms as well. And there was a Mishnah of Rabbi Meir, there's a Mishnah of Rabbi Chia, and those kinds of redactions are things that happened and were probably done by Rabbi Judah the Prince. Correct? Okay? Yes.
In interpreting any statute of law, you always go back to the person who wrote it. So mm-hmm. if you want to interpret the U.S. Constitution, you would go to the Federalist Papers,
correct.
And you would read what Madison wrote about what he meant when he wrote it.
Correct.
Well, you do the same thing in interpreting any statute. Correct. So similarly here, one would think that you would go back to the oral tradition because
correct.
It came first,
correct.
And those are the guys who first wrote it down.
Correct.
So I would conclude that it would be the oral tradition.
Correct.
You know, the problem with that is that somebody had to write down what the oral guys had said, and who knows if they wrote it down correctly.
Correct. Correct.
That's the dilemma that we're in.
That is basic to the context of the problem. Right, that's the context of the problem.
No Federalist Papers. Exactly.
Correct. You do not have that. You've got something close, which is the Talmud, but because it's so much older, and because there are so many gaps, you've just got problems as a result of that. There's no way to avoid it. Okay?
Is there a presumption among the tractates of the Talmud that none of them has priority over the others? Such that what you glean from all of them is the rule, and not that one was written earlier than another.
Well,
is there a hierarchy?
If I take your
conclusion?
The way you said it, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Because it doesn't matter whether something comes earlier or later, as far as the tractates go. Correct. It doesn't matter as far as that goes.
Right.
Because number one, we have no idea what the order is.
Oh, we don't. Oh.
We only know that they are in an order, but we have no idea exactly why they're in that order, number one. There has been speculation about the order. There's a speculation about, well, some of it is they're grouped by subjects to some extent. But within a subject area, for example, within the first order of the Mishnah, the Ra'im, okay? You have, I don't know how many tractates, maybe 10 tractates or so. Why are those in there?
So it may be a digest.
So it is largely a digest, and there is speculation among the commentators about why you have the order within an order, an order of Seder. Lama yesh Seder ba Seder. Why is there an order in the order? And Maimonides, for example, says that it's because they go by size orders. So that's not all that determinative. You know, if the largest tractate comes first and the second largest comes second, then there's why does Gittin come before Kiddushin? You know, why do the laws of divorce come before the laws of marriage? So then you have jokes. So the tradition there is Kadmarifu ala maka. You always put the antidote before the disease. So the bottom line is we have no idea. There really is no answer that's determinative in terms of applying the law. And the reality is that you can take those volumes and start anywhere and just keep going. It's not like a book where you have to start at chapter 1 in order to know what's happening in chapter 2. You could start in the end, and you are as much in tune and as baffled as you start at the beginning. And it doesn't make any difference. Okay. Let's go on. Now we're back to where we finally came to. We're on 4A1 on the right side of the page, Bet Shammai. We saw that Bet Shammai was also somebody who gave primacy to the Mikra. Aim la Mikra to the oral presentation of the text. So now the Gemara is going to go through each of these people. We've seen two of them so far. We saw Rebbe, and we saw, you remember, Rabbi Yehuda ben Ro'etz. Rabbi Yehuda ben Ro'etz, what was that? That was the one with Shiv'im and
Shivu'ayim.
Right, Shiv'im and Shivu'ayim. Okay? So, that was one. Now the second one was Bet Shammai. Bet Shammai, Omerim, Bet Shammai says, Ditanam, because we have a Mishnah, Kol ha-nitanim ala mizbeach ha-chitzon nitanam b'matana achat. Regarding all offerings whose blood is applied to the outer altar, if the Kohen made just one application instead of the stipulated two, kippah, then his putting of the blood on the altar has the effect of atoning. That is to say, I don't want to go into this in great detail. You can read the notes here if you're interested in the subject. Generally speaking, in the laws of sacrifices, the key element in sacrifices is not the sacrifice, but it is the pouring of the blood on the altar. Because hadam hu hanefesh, blood is the soul, this is the vital part of it, and most sacrifice, even if not all, most sacrifice has a purpose of atonement. And the act of atonement is an act of vicariously placing something that is of nefesh. Instead of your nefesh, this nefesh goes on. Okay? That's just in general what goes on here. But the key thing is, it's not the sacrifice, but it is the application of the blood on the altar. In a chatat, for example, a chatat is a sin offering that we know. It's obvious for the purpose of sin. You have to apply, you have to daub the blood on all four corners of the altar. Right? The altar has four horns on it. Go around and do it on four horns. All the other sacrifices don't require that. They require sprinkling of the blood down below. There's actually a line. There was a line on the mizbeach, on the altar. And this altar is a large thing. It's like a huge mound, but it's square, basically. And it's got a structure to it. It's got structures somewhat of pipes, because those things that are poured up at the top, they got to go somewhere. So they have a little bit of a pipe structure to it. And then there's a casting down below. There's a line, and you have to cast below that line. And you cast at the corner. So you cast twice, one at this corner and one at that corner. And that goes according to the Torah, because the Torah says exactly where you're supposed to do it. These are the kinds of things that most of us pay no attention to when you read the Torah. And I'm telling you this, and you say, Torah says that? I never saw that. I read the Torah 100 times. Believe me, next time you read it, keep that attention. It says all these things, but we sort of block, we glaze over when we get to those details. So it says you do it here and you do it there. So that's two. It's shtayim shehem arba. Two that are four. It's shtayim po, shtayim sham, but shtayim shehem arba, because they actually, when you do it twice, it falls on more than two sides. It falls on four sides. Right? Because you're doing it at the corner. So every time you hit a corner, as long as it's opposite corners, then in fact you hit four sides. Okay? So it's shtayim shehem arba. Well, basic to the law of sacrifice is that, number one, in the interpretation of the Torah, well, generally in the law, we say that certain things that are required, but if you don't do them, it still may be okay. We have this basic notion in the law. It's interesting. It's not necessarily intuitive, but it's not a bad idea. I'll give you an example. Tzitzis. You have a talis. Okay? The Torah says, you shall put on the four corners of your garment, you shall have tzitzit. Okay? It doesn't say only that. It says, Tabero ben Israel v'amata lehem rasu lehem tzitzit al kamtei videha. V'natnu al tzitzit ha-kanaf petil techeva. And they shall place on the tzitzit of the corner a petil techeret, a blue thread. A blue thread. Do you have a petil techeret on your talus?
Shame, shame.
Do you have a petil techeret on your
talus? I know that you
have. Okay.
I know that you
have. I happen to have a petil techeret. Barry's going to have a petil techeret. He's all set up for it. Almost there. But are you a sinner? Are you a sinner? Yes. You. How about the Gedolim? The great rabbis of Jerusalem. I just saw a bunch of them. And not one of them had a Petel Tachet. Are they all sinners because they don't have it? It's an interesting idea. We have this idea, we have this notion that sometimes there are competing ideas, and even though the Torah tells you to do it, if you don't do it, you can still get credit for it. It's as if you do a little bit, you get a lot. Right? You don't have to do the whole thing, but you have to do a part of it. We say you have to make kiddush. Make kiddush on a cup of wine. You have to drink the whole cup of wine? You don't. You don't have to drink the whole. You get a credit for a whole cup by drinking half a cup. Okay? Miksato kekulo. That's correct. We have in Shiva. It appears in many areas of the Lacha. As I said, it's not necessarily intuitive, because you assume that if God commands you to do something, you better do it, and you better do it right to the last detail. Because we assume that that's the way religion is, because that's the way some religious people are. They're kind of, how do you say it? They're compulsive, right? So we assume that this compulsive mentality is basic to religion, but the better for worse, it's not. The reality is that it really shouldn't be that way. So, in the laws of sacrifice, if you do one of the four up at the top, you still get credit for it. If you do one of the ones at the bottom, you still get credit for it. Well, how do we know that? How do we know that? Where is that from? That's what we're reading about now. This is from those discussions about the laws of sacrifices, where we learn, and it's based on texts, you'll see. I'll go through it quickly, but it's based on text. Okay, let's see. Keep it up. Shenemar v'dam zevachecha yishafech. It says, the blood of your sacrifices shall be spilled. Uvechatat shtei matanot. The blood of your sacrifices shall be spilled. Okay? It says, the blood, singular, shall be spilled. So you have sacrifices, but it says only one blood. Okay? Damim. Plural. Okay? Well, if they might have. If they wanted to, they could have. Okay? They don't have to.
A damim like what?
We don't know. I don't know. Yes, maybe not. I don't know. But here, this is technical stuff. Okay? This is technical stuff from the laws of sacrifices. And here they're making an effort to interpret it. No, I'm not saying that this is correct. I'm just saying that that's how he's interpreting it. So he says, shtei matanot. Uvechatat shtei matanot. And in the chatat offering, the Kohen must make at least two applications. Ubet Hillel omrim af bechatat shenitananda matana achat kiper. Bet Hillel says, no, only one of the four daubings of the chatat is enough. The Amar Rav Huna, and Rav Huna says, my tamad de Beit Shammai, what is the reasoning of Beit Shammai? That he says that just one is enough. Okay, what is Beit Shammai? Because scripture states that the blood be applied. Karnot, karnot, karnot. Oh, this is Beit Shammai's reasoning. Karnot, karnot, karnot. It says, the horns, the horns, the horns of the altar. It's mentioned three times, three different contexts. All right. So, hare kan shesh. Every time there's a plural, we take the minimum number of a plural is two. Three times two, six. So you would learn from that the horns, 2 plus 2 plus 2 is 6, it should be dubbed 6 times. Right? Beit Shammai is not learning that though, so let's see. Hare kan shesh, that adds up to 6. Arba la mitzvah ushtayim liakeiv. 4 of those, remember we learned before, that you have to be able to say the first time around, you can't derive something homiletically, because you need it for practical reasons the first time around. You're dealing with homiletic or hermeneutic interpretation, which is not necessarily practical interpretation. First time, or the first four is that you have to do this one, you have to do that one, you have to do this one, you have to do that one. That's four. How many have left over? Two. So two are repetitive. Two are repetitive. So from that, Beit Shammai learns, since two are repetitive, therefore two are essential, because basic to the laws of the hermeneutics of Torah as far as sacrifices go is that the obligatory side of it has got to be repeated.
You can't say karanot, karanot, like either or.
Correct.
You can't say and have the second one mean the first one even though it's spelled differently. You have to have two examples of the divergence.
Correct. Correct. Or at least possibly correct. Because Beit Hillel doesn't agree with this.
Oh, okay.
Beit Hillel Amrim. Beit Hillel says, Karnot, Karnot, Karnot. There are three mentions of Karnot. Alright? Karnot, the first one, has above. Alright? Second one is without above. Third one is without above. So Beit Hillel counts 2 plus 1 plus 1 is 4. He counts 4 from Karnot. Alright? Go back again. Shammai counted from the three mentions of Karnot 2, 4, 6. Because each one was pronounced. Eim la migra. Precedence is given to the oral way something is said, and each one was said in the plural. However, if you're going to take Eim la masoret, if you're going to allow precedence, not to the way something sounds, but to the way it's written, if you look at the way it's written here, it's Karnot has a vav, the first one, the next two don't have vavs. They're missing their vavs. So according to Beit Hillel, they're singular. They're singular, because if you don't have a vav, then you're not a true plural. Okay? Because Karnat, is a singular, a singular possessive. Right, Karnat. So, that's the difference between them. The difference between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel is for Beit Shammai, it's Eim la Mikra. Precedence is given to the way something sounds. For Beit Hillel, Eim la Masoret, precedence is given to the way something is written. Okay? But back to the same issue here. Let's go to another one. Okay. Well, I'm going to skip a little bit. I want to get to the next one because I want to move on with these. With the sukkah. Okay? You go down to 482 toward the bottom on the right side. No, let's see. It probably starts above that. No, I'm sorry, it starts.
Rabbi, she wants above.
Rabbi. Rabbi Shimon. Oh, Rabbi Shimon, because he was the next one who is mentioned in the people among the list of the people who believed in Eim la Mikra, that precedence is given to the oral tradition. Okay? That was Rabbi Shimon. Titanya. And here we have a Baraita. Shtayim kehochatan ushlishit afilu tefach. Two walls of a sukkah, and the third wall is just one hand's breadth in length. Right? Now, the minimal size of sukkah walls is, if I've got it right, 6 hand breadths. I've got that right. Minimal size is 6 hand breadths. He is saying here that the minimal number of walls in a sukkah is 3. Minimal number of walls in a sukkah is 3, which means 2 regular walls and one which is just a short wall. One which is just a partial wall. Okay? Now, we'll get to that in a minute. Okay? Alright, Rabbi Shimon. Titanya. Shtayim kehochatan u'shlishit afilu tefach. So the rabbis are saying we don't have any attribution to the beginning here, that a sukkah requires two walls and a third one that's a tefach. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, shalosh. A sukkah requires three walls, kehilchatan, three walls that are full size, and a fourth wall that's just a hand's breadth in length. Okay? So essentially now, Rabbi Shimon requires four walls in a sukkah, even though the fourth can be a short wall. The rabbis require three walls in a sukkah, the third of which can be a short wall. Okay? B'mai kamiflagei, what do the rabbis and Rabbi Shimon disagree about? Rabbanan savre yesh em lamasoret. The rabbis have the point of view that precedence is given to the written tradition, to the way in which these things are written in the Torah. Rabbi Shimon savar yesh em lamikra. And Rabbi Shimon takes the point of view that there is precedence not to the written, but to the oral way in which we are to read the written law. Rabbanan savre yesh em lamasoret. Now it's explaining to us how they derive this. The rabbis say that you take precedence goes to the written form. Basukot, basukot, basukot. And the law of sukkah repeats the word basukot three times. Three times. Okay? Basukot. Look at the first one. Basukot is written with a dot up in the top. Do you have any dots in the Torah? No way. No dots in the Torah. The Torah doesn't have dots. Okay? So the first one, which we're reading as Basukot, they're reading as Basukat. One. One. Second one is Basukot. Again. It doesn't have a vav. So they're reading it again as one. So that's one and one is two. Basukot, the third one is plural. Okay? Because it has a vav. It has a clear vav. So that's worth two. Okay? One and one is two plus two is four. All right? Basukot with vav. Hare kanam, arba. They add up to four. Keep going. Dalchad kralugufa. We have to take away the first one of them. Why? Because we have to have one of them for the purpose of teaching us the law of sukkah. Remember, the first mention of something is for the purpose of establishing the concept. In order to hermeneutically derive details about the concept, we can do repetitive. That's repetitive analysis. But whenever we add things up, the first one you have to subtract. Because that is simply the law of sukkah to begin with. We're going to go from that one in order to determine how many sides the sukkah has to have. All right, so we're down one. Kashu lahot plat. Okay, now we're up to three. Atai hilchata garata leshlishit v'okim ta'abtefa. There is alacha l'moshe mi-sinai. There is an oral tradition that goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai, which says that the last wall of the sukkah can only be a partial wall. Now that, there's no reason given for. The only reason is halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. You just learned from this one. That's God's will. That's God's will. So we learn God's will is, you may want to figure out why God would have such a will, but to begin with, from a halachic perspective, the last wall, halacha l'moshe mi-sinai, only has to be a tefach, one hand breadth. So, again, according to the rabbis, a sukkah requires three walls, and the third wall only requires a tefach. Now, let's go on with Rabbi Shimon. Wait a minute. Oh, what? Rabbi Shimon.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right, remember, the rabbis, it was 1 plus 1 plus 2 is 4. We had to subtract 1 because of the concept. We're left with 3. So 2 regular walls and 1 short wall. That's the law of the sukkah. Rabbi Shimon Savar, Rabbi Shimon says, Basukot, Basukot, Basukot. Alright, repeats the same thing again. Alright. Basukot, Basukot, Basukot. Hare kan shesh. Each one is a plural. Because he's going according to the way it's read, not the way it's written. So, 2, 4, 6. He's got 6 walls. He's got the number 6 anyway. Let's see what he does with them. Dal chad kra legufe. You have to subtract one of those scriptural sources in order to establish the notion of sukkah in the first place. That would be the first one. All right, so that's, we're down one, which actually was 2, but we're down 1. We're down 1 that's 2, so we're down, we started with 6, we're down to 4. Dalchad kra legufe, pashu laho arba. Therefore, we have four left. Atai hilchata. Then comes the halacha Moshe Misinai. Same thing. That the last wall, the fourth wall, can be a short wall. So that's the difference between the two. Okay? So here we see that Rabbi Shimon as well, in the law of sukkah, he disagrees with the rabbis because they also have differing points of view on the way to interpret scripture. Okay? One is Eim LaMikra, is the point of view of Rabbi Shimon, and the rabbis say Eim LaMasoret. Okay? Yes?
Might we have any instances of rabbis using Eim LaMikra in one place to support a position in Eim LaMasoret?
Well, it's more complicated than that, as you'll see in the Gemara. So hold on. If we get there, you'll see it. You probably won't get there tonight, but you'll see. Okay.
So how many walls do you want for next year's sukkah?
Oh, you're the sukkah man, right? Upstairs we have a good setup. We have a good setup because we actually have 4 walls in the sukkah. But those of you who remember our sukkah at 1384 Lexington Avenue, any of you remember that? How many walls do we have there?
Only 2, basically.
No?
The one at the back we used.
Well, that's so we could use the iron. You had that one, sure. You made that one too. You and Bill. That had 3 walls. That had 3 walls.
But it had 3 walls. But does no one point out that if you have 3 walls, unless the building is triangular, there's a suggested 4th wall that may not be a filled in panel, but it has 4 sides. Is it about sides or is it about walls?
When we study the laws of sukkah, you'll see. That, as an architect, you're sensitive to that. But it's very basic to the discussion about the sukkah.
But one wall be a minimum of a hand breadth wide does suggest that you have to have 4 things going on, whether it's a filled in panel or not.
You said it yourself. You said it the right way. Who is to say that it's supposed to be rectangular?
Well, I think there's a lot of things to say that it's rectangular. Because I can't believe that there's even a pyramid has 4 sides. Now they, you know, there's very little in building history where you would have a volume that had 3 sides like that.
I don't see why not.
You can have a sukkah with you.
I can imagine a pyramid.
But
why can't a sukkah be a pyramid?
4 sides.
What? Why does it have 4 sides? 1, 2, and the third one is over here. 3 sides.
Pyramid is 4.
Well, he's right.
It's not triangular in plan.
Oh, well, maybe I'm not using the right word.
So that's what I'm sort of saying, is there's very little, I don't know of any precedent of ordinary rooms or buildings that have 3 vertical sides, not walls, but sides. And that's why I say this is really a day.
Yes, I don't think we should go too much. You may be right, and in fact, you'll see the discussions in Masechet Sukkah about it. But it doesn't matter. Because if you're dealing with the interpretation of Scripture, we've got to know what the minimum is.
Yes.
We're not telling you that you've got to make your sukkah that way, but we are saying that if you come up with something, what is the minimum to fulfill the mitzvah? Right? We've already told you don't have to have the techelet on your tzitzis.
Right.
Right? Do you have to have all the walls in your sukkah? Do you have to daub all the blood on the altar?
I don't think you can have a room with only two sides. That doesn't make a room.
Well, but it could be a partial side. Could be a partial side. What's a side? What's a side? Okay? I don't think the issue... I think you're pushing the realia much too far here. None of this is based on realia. This is based on scriptural interpretation. And the issue is, how do people relate to the scriptural text? And what is the source, then, of the conclusions drawn from the scriptural text? Is primacy given to the written text or to the way in which the text is read?
What I'm finding interesting is those who are giving primacy to the way it's written aren't concerned about context.
Context.
Because you couldn't say besukat tation. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. So they're really taking that word out and
absolutely
double-wing in terms of the primacy.
Exactly. So once you've got a concept established by your first mention of something, and all the rest is really in a world, I called it a hermeneutic world. It's a world that's a mental construct. It's a world that's an abstract concept of ideas that comes out of that. And that is, certainly by these interpreters, is considered to be a perfectly reasonable way to interpret it. And our sense of context may or may not be relevant. Here it's not relevant.
If I were the Rabbanim here and I'm focused on the written work, the written tradition as my source, I might get confused because I understand my argument with Rabbi Shimon. At the end, I'm adding this third concept of interpretation and understanding, which is halacha
Sinai,
and that's oral.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a written dogmatist, mm-hmm. but in my own discussion, I'm saying oral tradition.
The point is well taken. I would only say in response to it that we shouldn't necessarily assume that the Gemara, the issue being pressed by the Gemara will last forever. Because, in fact, the Gemara is going to reject this. You know, everything that I want, once again, we're going to get to a gotcha. Because the Gemara is arguing a point of view that eventually it's going to reject. Okay, in all truth. And the point of view that it's going to accept is what you just said. It is going to, in fact, accept it, but then once it accepts it, it's not so sure it wants to accept it. Because, and here I'd like to just step back a little bit. I think that you really have here an argument that is an argument that I would like to suggest to you is an extraordinarily important argument from a religious perspective and from a philosophical perspective. Let me deal with the religious side of it first. In the Midrash, it's in the Talmud too, but I think it's best described in the Midrash, in the Tanhuma, one of the early collections of Midrashim. In the very first of the Midrashim in Bereshit, about the creation of the world, the following is the introduction. I'm just going to read to you the very beginning. Bereshit bara Elokim. That's what the Torah says. In the beginning, God created. Zesha mara katuv Hashem bechokhma yasad aretz. Where in Proverbs, scriptures say the Lord founded the earth with wisdom. And when the Holy One, blessed be He, created His world, He counseled with the Torah, and as a result of that, He created the world. This is an idea that you have in Plato. This is an idea that you have in Plato, and that is that all creation was first a creation of ideas, and then actual physical creation presupposes a creation of ideas that are non-substance, that don't exist in substance. For example, I can do it very simply. I don't want to do it exactly here, but if I have a rectangle here, okay? You would agree with me that this is a rectangle. Let's just agree on that. If I tear it into 100 pieces, have I destroyed rectangles? I've only destroyed that rectangle. Well, how does that work? Obviously, there is an idea of a rectangle that has primacy before a rectangle. Okay? We are aware of abstract concepts that, in fact, the experience of our world presupposes certain abstractions. That's Plato. That's Plato. This is what you're reading here as well. The rabbis have the same idea. They say that God looked at the Torah. The Torah is equivalent to the Platonic ideas. These are Platonic ideas. But in fact, they're Torah ideas. Okay? So the Torah is essentially a world of ideas to begin with. Right? God counseled with the Torah and created the world. Shenemar li etza v'tushia ani bina vigura. There's a verse here from the Proverbs. Listen. V'hatora bame hayeta ketuva. How was the Torah written down? We've just spoken now of a world of ideas. But you and I know that the Torah is not only a world of ideas, the Torah has to be written down. Al gabe esh levana de esh shechora. It was white fire and black fire. White fire and black. Al gabe esh levana. On white fire was black fire written. Extraordinary concept. On white fire was black fire written. It's the very notion that something that is written is black fire. Right? It has its own mystery. And behind it is white fire, because it would have no sense without the whiteness behind it. The whiteness provides its shape. It provides separation between letters, separation between words, and therefore we are totally interdependent between black fire and white fire. Both are fire. Both are fire. Okay? V'atorah bana ita ketuva alga be'esh levana be'esh shechora. Shenemar, as it says, and this is from the Song of Songs, Kvutzotav talpelin shechorot ka'orev. This is a description in the Song of Songs which they're taken totally out of context. What it means is the curls on the side of the head were twirled, curled, shechorot ka'orev, and black like a raven. It interprets it completely differently and says, Mahu kotzotav. As the jots and the tittles, taltalim, I'll call coats for coats. There are hills and hills, as we read in here, of details, hills and hills of halachot, ketzat. How? How can that come from the Torah? Ketzat katubba velot. Oh, and then it gives an example. What do you mean? V'lo techalalu et shem kodshi. You shall not desecrate my holy name. Im ata oseh chet hey. If you were to write the chet with a little less ink and it were to look like a hey, it would say, Ata macharib et ha'olam. You destroy the world, because it then says, Al tahalel et shem kodshi. Do not praise my holy name. What's the difference between praise and desecrate? A little bit of ink. A little bit of ink is the whole difference between praise and desecrate.
What are the two words?
Right? Techalel and tehalel. The difference between a hey and a chet is a tiny bit of ink. Right? Amazing, amazing. Because a whole list of these things. I'll read you one more. The whole page of them here. If you make a chet into a hay, you destroy the whole world. Every soul shall praise the Lord. If you turn that hay into a chet, you destroy the world, because you say every soul shall defame the Lord. Okay? The Chen Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Similarly, with Shema Yisrael, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Imata Oset Dalet Resh. If you take off the end of the Dalet on the right side, what does it look like? A Resh. Atamacharive Et Olam. You destroy the world, because it says the Lord is another. In other words, that's a statement for idolatry. It's a statement for idolatry. So in other words, we started out here with the notion of black fire on white fire. Black fire on white fire. The Ramban, Nachmanides, very beginning of his perush, his commentary to the Torah, writes a rather lengthy introduction. It's an introduction about the nature of revelation, the giving of the Torah. I'm going to read to you a section which is two-thirds of the way through his introduction. Od yesh b'yadenu kabbalah shel emet. Moreover, we have a Kabbalah shel emet. Now he's talking about Kabbalah. We have a mystical truth. We have a mystical truth. Ki kol ha-Torah kula shmotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The entire Torah consists of God's names. The whole Torah is a combination of God's names. Shahatevot mitchalkot l'shemot the inyan acher, that the words themselves can be split into names that mean something else. Ki ilu tachshov al derech mashal, if you think, for example, ki pasuk bereshit, if you have the bereshit bara Elokim, first three words of the Torah, you can divide that up litevot acherot into other words, kagon Barosh Yidbara Elohim. Same letters can be read Barosh, in the beginning, God was created. That's exactly the opposite. In the beginning, God creates. But if you separate the letters differently, it can say in the beginning, God was created. How do you know? How do you know? The Chol HaTorah came. This is true throughout the entire Torah. Milvan Serufehem de Gematriotehem Shel Shemot. With the exception of names. Ukvar Katav Rabbeinu Shlomo Beferusho B'Talmud. Already Rashi wrote in his interpretation of the Talmud, Inyan Hashem HaGadol Shel Shivim Ushtayim. There is a great name of God which has 72 letters. This is an interpretation that Rashi has in the Talmud. Umitneze Sefer Torah Sheta'a Bo Ba'ot Achat. Therefore, if there is one letter that is in error, that is wrong in a Sefer Torah, bimalo o bechaser. If you have a vav or you left out a vav, pasul. The Torah is no good. You can't use that Torah. Ki ze ha'inyan yechayev otanu lifsol Sefer Torah. This matter can invalidate a whole Torah. Sheyechasar bevav echad, because it's missing one vav. Afal pisha eno malav eno morid, even though it makes no difference in the way it sounds. Right? Though it doesn't matter. Kafi ha'olev machshava, in any reasonable way. And he goes on. V'zehu ahinyan shehevi gedolei ha'mikra, this is the matter behind the great ones who studied the Mikra, limnot male v'chaser, to count the letters that are male with the vav or chaser without the vav. B'chol ha'Torah v'Mikra, throughout the entire Torah and the whole Bible, ulechaber sefarim b'masoret, and to write books of the masoret. Now you remember what masoret means. Yesh ein la masoret. The written form takes precedence. They were very concerned about the written form. Ad Ezra hasofer, till Ezra the scribe, shenishta belbaze, who worked on this. Dinire, it seems, shahatorah haketuva, that the Torah which is written be'esh shechora, in black fire, al gabei esh levana, on top of white fire, b'inyan hazeh shehizkarnu haya, as we've mentioned, shehayeta haketiva retzufa, b'inyan hazeh shehizkarnu haya, shehayeta haketiva retzufa, if there had been straight letters, b'li efsek tevot, without any separation of words between them, Vayav shar kriyata shetikra al derech hashemot v'tikra al derech kriyatenu. And it was possible to read it completely differently, not the way we read it. B'inyana Torah mitzvot. We read it in order to derive from it Torah and mitzvot, teaching and commandments. V'natna l'moshe Rabbeinu al derech chiluk kriyata mitzvah. Moses received it in knowledgeably knowing where to separate between the letters.
So we've got the Nazi code.
Right? So this is crucial, otherwise you wouldn't know what to do. You wouldn't know what to do without, and what does that presuppose? The oral tradition. You have to have an oral tradition, because otherwise you are left with the mystery of the black letters on the white. You have to have the knowledge of where the white fire is in order to be understand what the Torah requires of you. Right? I'm just going to go a little bit further. Excuse me if I just keep going. I wanted to note to you that, and I have an article to give to you, that in modern philosophy, one of the subjects that has fascinated, has sort of been in the cutting edge of philosophy, is deconstructionism. Deconstructionism is a view of essentially being, of existence, where, according to Derrida, the word is before everything. All reality is essentially words. Language takes precedence over everything else. Without language, there is absolutely no reality whatsoever, to put it shortly. And one of the perspectives on Derrida, which we've seen over the last few years, is to analyze his writing from the perspective of his Jewishness. He was an alienated Algerian Jew who was a Frenchman, And there's a real question about whether he was influenced by Judaism or not. This, people who know far more about the subject have written a great deal. But Derrida is a writer who is interested in the relation between the black and the white, between the writing that is there and the whiteness that is behind it, feeling that every blackness requires whiteness, and that in fact all of this is the most basic building block of the entire creation itself, which happens to be, in my opinion, what the Midrash Tanhuma said, that all of this is a notion of really what creation is about. I wanted to therefore hand out to you, if you're interested in the subject, this is an article by Professor Elliot Wolfson of New York University, who is a professor of Kabbalah, and wrote about the Kabbalistic traces in the margins of Derrida. So you might find this interesting, and I think that what you will see is that Kabbalah, which talks about the black fire and the white fire, as I read to you a moment ago in Rambam, really is dealing with very much the same issues which we've seen here in the Talmud. I think that when the Talmud is discussing Ein L'Masoret and Ein L'Mikra, that is really what they are dealing with. We're essentially dealing with, how do we have any comprehension at all? How do we know anything? Our very ability to have any knowledge, which is to say to have any sense of reality, to have a concept of being in existence, presupposes a notion of separation, presupposes a concept of language, and it presupposes an endless reality of coming to terms with interpretation. Now, Wolfson and others, I think, write convincingly that Derrida is not a Kabbalist, and he's not really writing classical Judaism by any means. But because there are assumptions that Kabbalists make and that the Talmud is making about a reality which is a God-created reality, which somebody like Derrida is rejecting. He's an atheist. That having been said, the coincidence between them is quite amazing. It's quite amazing.
Before I was an architect, I studied philosophy at NYU. I didn't study with Wolfson, but I studied Derrida and Foucault. And my argument has always been, my problem with them has always been, that they use the very tools that they deny the sort of rationale for their being. How can you have language and the conventions of language and the pain that arises from the conventions of language if you deny that, if you say that it's arbitrary and a construct that has no root in any...
That's fine.
Okay.
I just want us to see... Where the sameness, you're right about the difference. The difference is quite profound. The critique from a religious perspective is quite fitting. But let me just go a little bit further. Let me say a few more words more. According to Wolfson in the article, the key to the relationship between deconstruction and Judaism lies in the Jewish mystical view that reality is a text. Reality is a text. It is really a text that is at the basis of all reality. The world, and in mysticism, it is all of the text is essentially a mystery of God's name. That's what I was reading to you in Ramban. It is all somehow a revelation of some hidden reality that is divine, which, of course, Derrida would never accept. But Wolfson quotes from Rabbi Tzadok Kohen of Lublin. Thus I have received that the world in its entirety is a book that God, blessed be He, made, and the Torah is the commentary that He composed on that book, which He compares with Derrida's assertion that there is nothing outside the text. That is the statement of Derrida. There is nothing outside the text. The text is the essence of everything. You have nothing, you have no existence without the text. So here, I don't think we're the same, but you can see that this tension in the Jewish corpus between the text and the need to come to terms with the difficulty and the endless preoccupation with the understanding of the text, as well as the uncertainty of whether the understanding precedes the text or the text precedes the understanding. The text would be the black fire that is on the white fire. Of course.
So, the whole thing is very abstract, so I have to get a little bit more concrete. So this idea, though, which is so interesting and mysterious, and it's one long series of letters without division, so that it can be variously interpreted, is different than what we all accept, which is that God read this or spoke this and Moses wrote it down. If it's spoken, it's not all one string of letters. It's meaningful and it has purpose, and it is for didactic and for purporting to spoke. And it's a narrative in order to get to that. So it's a very different, once again, the words versus listening. One is a visual string of things that you can variously put together because it's a string and then make sense out of for the other people. And the other is that it starts out as an oral story and commandments that you just transcribe because it's purposefully said to you in God's voice, and it's quite different than that. So once again, you've got these two very different schools that are going on, depending on which one you choose. The Kabbalistic is the one I assume that is the series, right, with the 72 letters, which is always, to me, less practical. To me, it's for a variety of things. So, obviously, the more concrete of us are used to that other rendition.
That's what Nachmanides was saying, that ultimately the way we have the text is for practical reasons, so that we know what the Torah and the mitzvot are, because that was God's concern that we know about those things. Which is not to say that a preoccupation with the other way of looking at the text is an invalid.
Why does it require that? Why is it invalid? What use does it have?
Yes.
Could it be that Moses imposed a narrative structure on what God shared? That Moses could either perceive or represent what God commanded was through a story, mm-hmm. but that the reality is just text.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that for sure, but I would say that I think what Bobby is saying, what you're saying, they both work together. They can work together,
right,
because in fact, even if the oral text and the way in which, therefore, the text has its white spaces defined for it is crucial, and we know that by virtue of having heard it, still the reality is that when we read the text, we think of something else. Inevitably, when we read the text, we will say, well, maybe the text doesn't mean this, maybe it means that. Maybe we can apply it in a different way. Maybe we can do this, maybe we can do that. Maybe there's a history to the text. Maybe this text itself developed.
Well, we don't say it doesn't mean anything.
Right? Maybe this text developed. Now, all of this is because we're looking at the text. Once we look at a written text, we analogize between that written text and so many other areas of our lives, and that's the place where we are. There is no way that we cannot be in two places at once.
Maybe the capitalist today would look at it as a digitization of
that's going to be a very interesting piece of what's coming in as a result of the digitization of things. I really think that some of these questions are, the forcefulness of the question is coming back, because it's a question of what a text is, and the permanence of a text, and the experience of relationship to the text. The relation that you have to a parchment text is, in my mind, totally different than the relation you have to a computer screen. We've assumed that they're exactly the same thing, that it's the same thing. I think that one of the conversations that we will have down the road, maybe 5 minutes from now, is whether they are the same thing. Okay.
I want to throw in what the evolutionary psychologist would say, because it's not a coincidence that Stephen Pinker. Is both an evolutionary psychologist but also a linguist and spends most of his scholarship on language and the nature of the meaning of language. And I think that you have to, from a theological standpoint, take into consideration that God would know what our brains were actually capable of handling. Creates text that we can almost understand in ways that he knows we have the capacity to understand, because our brains are not neutral computing machines. They're actually highly molded by an evolutionary history as well. And the second piece of this that I would throw in is our, again, probably from evolutionary psychology or however you want to frame it, is our attachment to metaphor, the inextricable connection between language and metaphor, and the inadequacy of us to understand things outside of metaphor, and how desperately we search for metaphor in order to comprehend. And that's probably a reflection of the limitations we have in terms of our neurons. Mm-hmm. We just can't get it other ways. Now, there are some mathematicians who you know, totally disconnected from that and can live at a level of abstraction that the vast majority of us don't have the capacity to. So I think that all of this has to be put in that sort of biologic context as well.
It's very interesting. To be continued.
Did anybody compile like the greatest hits of the Talmud?